The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. I was reading The Economist magazine on Sunday night right before I came in, and it struck me, you know, The Economist magazine, of course, they try to be fair and they try to understand both sides of the issues. I consider it relatively socialist because it's still European, even though they try to set themselves apart. But I read an article, Dave, that just made my blood boil. And the article was, again, for the average person, probably very balanced, but they had no idea really what they were saying. They were talking about just pure theft becoming the norm in our society. And of course, what I'm talking about is this gentleman was saying quantitative easing really no longer is just an extraordinary measure. It's something that central banks probably will be doing for the next 10 or 20 years. We may have reached a turning point where we've realized that this is something that central banking's just going to do.
Crossed the Rubicon, so to say.
Yeah.
Well, do we live in a new era of central planning? And that's sort of the question suggested in the article. There is this growing presumption on the part of the market and market practitioners that the central bank activity, that, you know, okay, let's say this was past tense now.
Right.
It used to be extraordinary and daring, and it's not so very dangerous and daring anymore. Merely now the new era's boring and highly scientific approach. And by scientific, again, it sort of builds in the credibility to it, right? Because that's the age we live in, one of science and clear understanding.
Well, you know, they're assuming that there's no consequence anymore. Yeah, they're saying there's no inflation. You know, we're printing money and it's really just turning into growth is their attitude.
Right. So A, it works without a hitch, and B, it has no unintended consequences. And we can conclude these two things because in the rear view, now granted, we haven't gone very far down the road, but in the rear view, there's been no hitches thus far, and we've not seen any unintended consequences thus far. I would tend to agree with you, Kevin. I would suggest that the market concluding these things is completely delusional.
Well, and has there ever been a time in history when printing money out of thin air hasn't turned into a negative consequence? I was just looking back at the end of the book that you've recommended over and over, David, When Money Dies by Adam Ferguson. And, you know, it's about the hyperinflation, as you know, in Germany in the early 1920s. It just devastated a country. Yet when he was writing his epilogue, he was amazed. And here's the quote that it said. It says, "Their total blind refusal to connect the mark's depreciation with money supply was amazing. You know, knowledge of currency laws, particularly of quantitative theory, was incredibly absent from German mindset."
Well, I'm impressed by the candor of one of the Fed presidents, the CEO and president, Richard Fisher from the Dallas Fed. And I please, for those of you listening, avail yourself of the 9-page speech he gave in Hong Kong last week. You can follow the link on our
speech. Yeah.
Follow the link on our commentary website, and you'll be able to read that. You'll find several points of concern in that speech, which we've highlighted on the program, including, you know, equities being overvalued, margin debt being at record highs, loans being made with very little documentation, like the covenant light loans of 2005 to 2007, those vintages, and the junk bond yields now declining below, you know, 5.5%. Currently near record lows. Also, he echoes William White's very candid reflection that, you know, the work of a central bank committee is not a hard science, as it's now being commonly perceived and as The Economist is suggesting it should be, contrasting Fisher's experience as a money manager, because remember, he was a money manager prior to being a central banker. We then have the very, very different character, the academic reflections of Miss Janet Yellen.
Well, in such a contrast, you know, I've got to admit, Dave, I'm not a real fan of central bankers, and we have had central bankers on the program. Nice guys, but they have this view of management from the top. Now, what I like about Richard Fisher's speech, honestly, I thought he had been listening to the commentary, Dave, to be quite honest with you. I mean, the things that he listed in that speech as a concern, and I have to give this guy credit. If this guy would run the Fed, I'd be a voter. How about you? I'd say, yeah, put him in.
Still not a huge fan of the Fed, except that if you had somebody in charge who was making very clear market-oriented decisions instead of decisions which were primarily oriented to models, I think that's the real danger that we have today, is the hubris and assumptions that go into the models that drive the Fed's analysis. So, well, you've got Yellen. She says this last week that the work of the Fed is really for the children. Well, this is her quote. "Our goal is to help Main Street not Wall Street. You know, and I could go on and on with that particular quote because she illustrates over and over again how the work of the Fed is for the common man. And that, my fellow Americans, is why interest rates are at record lows. It's not, I repeat, not to rebuild bank balance sheets.
Oh, of course not.
It was not, I repeat, not what those in academics call financial repression.
Oh, of course not. No.
Income is diverted from households and savers to act as a subsidy for financial interests, both private and public. And of course, I'm talking about the discounted interest payments for the national debt. That's the public benefit. Then the private benefit being, you know, the companies which have been given near interest-free money by the Fed. That's your banks and financials.
Well, and of course, we've seen how much wealth has been distributed to the high side, you know, the wealthy side through this. And, you know, just let's just look at New York. My daughter lived in New York for a couple of years.
One surprising data point. For 2013, the average cost of a Manhattan condo per square foot rose 24%. Now, this is in a single year. And according to an April 1st Bloomberg report, now, I want you to guess. I want you to guess what the cost per square foot is for your average Manhattan condo or co-op. Drum roll. Put a number in your mind. What's your best guess? Cost per square foot.
I thought it was like $1,000 a square foot just last year.
If you guessed $1,363 a square foot, you were correct. So basically, $1 million buys you just a skosh below 750 square feet. $1 million, just under 750. Think about
that. So she did do that for the children.
Yeah, Janet is driving asset prices higher for the children. And the man in the street.
The man in the street. It's Main Street.
A different kind of man, perhaps, or woman. Home prices here have rebounded on the back of interest rate suppression. Okay, we know that. It is a bought rate, complements of the Fed and the QE program, wherein they've been buying anywhere from 85 to 100% of mortgage-backed securities. And, of course, the other asset that's benefiting, for now, from Fed policy is the stock market. The Fed has created a context where values and equities are equal to what we witnessed just prior to the bear markets of 1907, 1937, and 1968. Kevin, there's only two periods of time where stocks have been in extremis more overvalued, 1929 and 1999.
Well, I think this is worth going back and looking at this. 1907 was the financial crash that ultimately led to the need, quote, for the Federal Reserve. Okay, I mean, it was a huge crash. And then in 1937, that was when the stock market turned back down again in 1968. But 29 is the crash that was supposed to rock the world and never be repeatable. But we've had, actually, Dave, look at what happened in 1999. The NASDAQ was over 5,000 points, and even though the NASDAQ has roared back from its bottom, we're still not even where we lost ground from after 1999.
Well, this gets to the point that was made, I think, very eloquently by Andrew Smithers. We're 70% overvalued in the stock market, and right. That doesn't mean it can't go further, and these kind of valuation metrics are not a timing mechanism, you know, that tell you, okay, now that we've hit 71%, overvalued, it's time to sell. Now, you can go to far higher levels of overvaluation, but you are playing a fool's game in terms of momentum carrying you forward, not necessarily value purchases or value proposition.
Well, let's address that, though, Dave. Let's address that for a second, because so many people say, well, if you're just in the stock market for the long haul, you really don't need to look at those types
of things. Well, ask yourself this question. Are you an investor or a trader? A trader will consider themselves nimble enough to exit the market in time prior to a crash, and all traders think the same thing. And the vast majority, you know what they end up doing? Riding the wave up and all the way down again. The momentum is intoxicating, and the thoughtfully planned exit, you know what? It's very, very rarely executed. Now, on the other hand, you've got the investor who says, you know, I own stocks for the long run. Temporary price corrections, they don't faze me. Mine is a cast iron stomach. So, and I would say this to you, Mr. Investor, Mr. Cast Iron Stomach Man, order your bottle of Pepto-Bismol. An adventure is brewing. I would suggest that between now and 2016, you're looking at 30 to 50% declines in the current stock market. You're talking about, again, 30 to 50% of those current values up in smoke.
Well, and it's been amazing how this quantitative easing and the cooperation between Wall Street and the Fed has kept things going.
And the Fed, frankly, in a similar vein, sees the affordability of cars for the masses at 0%. That's a gift to the children. For those families that will now be able to make it to a new job, yeah, and this is from last week's jobs number, the birth-death modeling created. So from last week's job number, you've got the birth-death modeling, which created 75,000 jobs last month.
Well, that's just an accounting change, Dave. That those were not real jobs. They just did that on paper. They did that for 600,000 jobs last year.
Right, and these are not the kinds of jobs you drive across town to, because they don't actually exist. Huh. Wait, before we move past the Manhattan co-op, I forgot to mention that that $1,363 a square foot, that's not a luxury accommodation. That's an existing old building, an existing co-op or condo. New construction, and this stuff is in high demand, wrap your minds around this, is selling for between $1,800 and $3,000 a square foot. I just want to stop and pause and say, thank you, Ben. I want to say thank you, Janet.
Maybe you should have your children say
children,
thank you
children,
as well.
Children, say thank you. Thank you, Janet. Children, say thank you.
Well, okay, so if indeed they're trying to drive the economy and try to drive new spending, and even though you and I don't agree debt spending necessarily, okay, where is the debt going right now? Where's the consumer borrowing?
Yeah, 98% of new consumer credit has been in two areas, car loans, with a large percentage of those being at 0%, and student loans, the majority of which have an interest component that is deferrable for many years. Now, the common characteristic between these two kinds of consumer credit, again, autos and student loans, is that they draw consumption forward in time in a far more dramatic way than credit cards or other consumer credit, because these are big ticket items. I mean, again, you're talking about things that could be $20,000, $60,000 if you're talking student loans. A car, again, it could be $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for one single item. And what they're doing, again, is creating a sense of obligation for many years to come. 0% financing, this is again for 2, 3, 5 years, that's just one example of autos allowing for an affordable purchase up front, but with the sting of owning, frankly, a depreciated asset.
Well, and you've said often, Dave, don't borrow, especially on a depreciating asset. There are times in a business where you may borrow on something that will appreciate or you have potential future growth, but depreciating an asset, you know, and most of us will go out and borrow for a car, but what you're saying is this is between student loans and auto loans, that's making up almost all of the borrowing right now.
Yeah, and this, the variable you just mentioned, it's a very important financial principle. You don't want to borrow for a depreciating asset. I mean, and this is, I think, one of the Achilles heel of the middle class. You want something you can't afford, so you borrow it, and then it's worth half of what you paid for it. But wait a minute, it's not just what you paid for it. You paid twice that number because interest had to be imputed to the total cost, too. Never a good idea to borrow money for a depreciating asset. Now, here's the thing. Unless, of course, the money is free. And that's where Fed policy has changed the dynamic here and taken what is a clear financial principle and said, well, but there's an exception. Here's the carve-out.
Yeah, because you're not paying interest.
Exactly. So, so the other example is student loans, which can be deferred for a period of time, and students can even seek forbearance, in which case principal payments are suspended temporarily, and that period of time interest continues to accrue, and it's added to the principal balance. The point being here is that consumption is being drawn into the present from the future, and an interest component is then added. So all these students who are now happy with having a degree, something that they can put up on the wall, guess what they don't get to do? Now that they have tens of thousands, in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt, but usually tens of thousands, they don't get to be the next generation of homebuyers. Right. So, you know, the Fed's great efforts to help the middle class, to help the man on the street, interest is cheap, everyone deserves an education, and everyone should be putting on the tab to get an education? You're basically, again, drawing what would have been future consumption, that of a whole generation that would have been buying homes, and now they're servicing debt on their Sallie Mae loans. It's a wreck. It's a train wreck.
Well, and, you know, we look at these interest rates and we say, well, gosh, if they stay at zero, maybe we're going to see a dynamic change, a paradigm shift. But interest rates go up, okay? And so you talked about this generation not being able to buy a house. Right now, mortgages are just about as low this last few years as we probably will see in our lifetime.
Right. 4.4 is about the 30-year rate, and, you know, it's bounced between 4 and 4.5. Now, I remember 25 years ago, my parents sold a home in the Denver area, and at closing, I was there and listening to the disclosures. This is when you had both parties in the same room. Now they separate you out. And we looked at how much interest was going to be paid by the new owner at the end of 30 years. And the interest piece was equal to the amount being paid for the home. And I mean, it was a total shock to me. It was a total shock to them, too. But I mean, again, this is consumer credit is exactly what it says. Normal consumption with an interest payment attached to it. Whatever's purchased on credit, if carried for any time at all, will have a far greater economic cost to the individual. And you've heard it said, never pay retail, right?
Right.
Well, try paying retail with interest. You can think of interest payments this way. You walk into a store to purchase something. The store owner says to you, oh, do I have a special deal for you? I have a special deal for you. You could pay retail, but why not pay even more than the sticker price? Why not pay twice for the same item?
Well, it reminds me of the old, you know, encyclopedia salesman. You know, you don't really feel it if you're just giving up a Coke or two Cokes a day. You know, you can afford these encyclopedias, but you know, are people actually going into debt right now on credit cards? You know, for at least for decades, that was the issue. People were just running up their credit cards. But I wonder if this financial crash sort of took the air out of those sales.
Yeah, there's not a lot of activity there in terms of the growth of consumer credit, 2%. I mean, it's a very low number relative to the rest of total consumer credit. The only places people are regularly duped is in education, ironically, and automobiles. So back away and just listen to that. To understand the great divide between rich and poor, you have to appreciate the difference in resource management. There is a difference between creating liabilities, that is, borrowing to consume, which represents a financial boat anchor, and on the other hand, creating assets. It could be tangible assets, they could be financial assets, which in theory leave open the opportunity for further growth of those assets in a parallel track while you're still adding savings and boosting your overall net worth. So just reflect on that. Debt is the means by which individuals live the life they want but cannot afford at this particular juncture.
Well, David, one of the things we pride ourselves in this nation is our freedom, okay? But if a person is deep in debt and they're living month to month and just continuing to take from the future what their earnings would be and apply them to the current, isn't that a form of servitude? Isn't that a form of slavery?
I think so. I mean, again, you're bringing the future, consumption and pleasure, the enjoyment of goods and services, whatever it may be, into the present, and in return you're signing on for a subtle form of servitude. The borrower, servant to the lender, that person could certainly wait to consume at a time in the future when savings were sufficient for purchase, but that's not the modern zeitgeist. We want what we want, and we want it now, even if it costs twice as much when you impute the credit or the interest costs. So the issue of wealth disparity is really central to our current Fed policy, because while Ms. Yellen may say it's for the families and for the children that rates are this low, a market practitioner will tell you all you're doing is enticing a greater number of people into debt servitude, right, a move towards negative net worth, with the equal and opposite impact in the market being asset price appreciation. This is a boon, of course, to owners of assets. Thus, you have the rich that are richer, the poor that are poor, not because of the evil of the market or the evil of Wall Street, but because there are dots to be connected. They have to be connected. The dots between Fed policy and market pricing. There is an impact. There is a consequence. Today, we have the American dream, which was never one of servitude, and yet it's been repackaged in the modern era. It's a dream that has obligation and expectation implicit in it. It's not a vision of freedom. As you mentioned, this is the notion of the American dream. It is one of freedom, and yet today it's been converted, it's been polluted, it's been distorted, and it's been done via the appeal of consumerism and the materialist illusions of personal well-being and significance. Somehow you can buy yourself into happiness.
Well, and Dave, I mean, isn't this the message of Keynesianism? Granted, Keynesianism is many things, but one of the things that Keynes talked about was having zero interest rates as long as you possibly can and trying to keep people consuming. And, you know, I remember after 9/11, Bush came out, and as a patriotic act, he told us to go spend money. Now, that to me was just, it was an amazing thing. We had built this country with savings, and now we were being told that it was patriotic to go spend and borrow.
You know, again, when you think about the consumerism, the materialistic delusions I was just alluding to, it's in this context that I can't help think that Mrs. Yellen is almost like, I know this isn't entirely respectful, so forgive me, but like the witch in Hansel and Gretel.
The metaphor.
Exactly. Right. The children are lured by candies and other sweet delights. There's something that is deeply appealing at just a basic level, or even a base level. And yet the witch is in fact doing it for the children. She's going to cook and eat them.
Well, and okay, so that's the borrowing side. Okay, we've got the witch who's offering candy, and the candy actually is debt servitude. But the other side of that equation, there's always two sides to an equation, is the lender. Okay, the bond market tells us an awful lot about risk in the market, normally, unless it's being artificially changed.
Well, the key word you use there is normally.
Yeah.
And it has been changed. So let's revisit what's taken place in the bond market in the last few years. You roll the clock back to 2011, and you have the crisis in Europe. On the basis of that, you had interest rates on European debt, which were 5 to 7% higher than the equivalent U.S. debt.
They spiked because of the risk.
They did. So, yeah. So what changed in 2011 was a comment uttered by Mario Draghi, 2012, promising to do anything needed to stabilize the market. Words.
Right.
The power of words. Mm. Spanish debt is now, fast forward to the present, is now within 0.5% of the U.S. 10-year treasury. French, German, and British 10-year paper trades at actually lower levels than U.S. debt. This
wow.
is, you know, again, Germany's actually cheaper on a basis point comparison, 117 basis points difference. Their debt is cheaper.
How far we have come, Dave. I mean, the shows that we were doing a couple of years ago were about the possible non-survival of Europe. There were people that we had on that said, look, the euro's probably not going to make it, but they've bought time with Draghi saying, look, we're going to do what America did. We're going to do what Abe did. Quantitative easing seems to over and over be the only answer that they're coming up with, the printing of money.
What they're dealing with is such a low inflationary environment in Europe that at present they're concerned they may slip into outright deflation. And Draghi has commissioned the ECB to go ahead and study what it would look like, what the market impact would be, to move into a similar quantitative easing that we have had in the United States for treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, in this case buying corporate bonds in Europe, to the tune of about €1 trillion. What will the impact be? And again, we're talking about a distortion of pricing because you've got this outside buyer. It's unnatural and ultimately unsustainable, but in the short run, there's a major impact.
Well, and so what does that do to high-yield bonds? Because if you know the government's going to come in and start buying corporate bonds, then they feel like they've got a backstop there, too.
There's a knock-on effect throughout sort of the credit structure. And the Fed president, you know, I mentioned the Fed Fisher's speech from Hong Kong. You have to read the speech. It's excellent. High-yield bonds trade with interest rates near 5.5%. He mentioned it. We've mentioned it before. What this implies is that the Fed's policies of interest rate suppression have had a major impact in the investment
They've
markets.
They've removed the perception of risk.
Yeah, yeah. But it's been tremendously inflationary for asset prices. That's stocks, that's real estate, that is bonds. They've boosted the value of bonds higher, and interest rates have thus fallen to the floor. But income seekers, now you've got income seekers, investors looking for income that are scouring the earth for something that's very hard to find.
Sure, the retired class.
Yield, income, it's basically gone the way of the dodo bird. It's very hard to find. So now we're witness to an epic distortion of investor behavior. As investors, I mean, these are folks that are generally risk averse. And yes, they're seeking a very predictable outcome. Just let me clip my coupon. Let me have my 3%. Let me have my 5%. Let me have my 7% income on savings. They're still seeking the old income levels, but they are in a new world of underappreciated risk and overpriced assets. And recall, this is our newest and most important money mandarin that has told us this, that has told us that it's good for Main Street. Thank you, Miss Yellen. It's good for Main Street, not Wall Street. Not Wall Street. Never mind that the U.S. and Europe issuance of junk bonds is going through the roof. So, yes, it's going through the roof to meet investor demand. And I want you to recall that when we're talking about junk bonds, we're talking about companies that are either poorly run or have rotten credit risks.
Well, all right, let me just ask, though, Dave. If this doesn't work, and it's never worked before, where you can just print for free your solution, print your wealth for free, then what we have is the collapse or the non-payment back of principal. You know, I think of what Will Rogers said years ago. And he was a man of many wise sayings, but I love the one where he said, I'm not so concerned about the return on my principal, but I definitely want a return of my principal.
And that's where the carnage that fixed income investors will experience as sort of unsuspecting savers right now, squeezing into investments that are quite risky. I think this is where they're going to be astounded. We talked about potential risk and downside in the stock market earlier. Well, you could expect 40 to 65% losses in high yield products. as interest rates normalize, and may end up that may end up being a conservative estimate of losses. By the way, you don't have to be a junk bond investor to lose in the fixed income space. You just have to be on the wrong side of an interest rate trend.
Well, and I think we should point out, Dave, that the trend has been for lower rates because the government's been the buyer. They create the money, they're the buyer, and you know, how much do they own? Like mortgage-backed securities, the mortgages that are out there, and the treasuries that even the government's borrowing themselves. The Fed owns a lot of that, don't they?
Right, and this is just one last point on the losses in fixed income. Why do we think you should be on the right side of interest rate trend, not on the wrong side? Well, this is goes back to Knut Wicksell's comments. Knut Wicksell was an 1800s, 19th century economist in Sweden, basically said if you suppress interest rates, if you keep them too low too long, they will end up going significantly higher, and you won't be able to control that. That was his conclusion, and his work's never been refuted. So the idea that somehow we can keep interest rates low forever, there's other variables that make that possible.
So it's an illusion.
I mean, it's a reality in Japan, but you also have a very compliant culture in which, you know, savings are virtually mandated in Japanese yen terms. You look at the average U.S. investor, and it's a very different character. You know, we think for ourselves we're much more cowboys, you could say. And no, we do not succumb to social expectations and pressures the same way you do in a place like Japan. So I'm not trying to be rude or anything. I'm just saying that there are elements afoot that allow for a low interest rate environment to still capture the interest of Japanese investors. We noted this about 2 months ago, that even that is beginning to fade. They're now advertising Japanese bonds. You know, if you want to be sort of the sexiest guy on the street, if you want to attract the ladies, you should be investing in Japanese government bonds. They've actually had to move to sex appeal with Japanese government bonds, because actually that traditional go-to of local or domestic consumption for those bonds, it's waning.
So what you have is a new generation who may not just out of their cultural need buy bonds.
And that's Japan. Here, I mean, again, it's just a question of how long they can keep them suppressed. They can do it longer than we think, certainly. But when they lose control, it's going to be a very, very big deal. Fiscal disaster, monetary disaster, market disaster, both in the stock and bond market. Having said that, today the trend is lower rates, and I think everyone is aware that the trend is utterly manipulated by the Fed's buying the benchmark in order to lower those levels. You know, they're buying, as Fisher says in his speech, 85% of all mortgage-backed securities paper. Well, that's today. Yesterday it was 100%.
Right.
And today it's only 85%. And it'll end up being a total of 40% of all mortgage-backed securities in aggregate that the Fed sits on as an asset on their balance sheet. They're going to own 40% of the market. I mean, if you think about that, it's preposterous to think that home buying today is somehow a market activity. It's not a market activity.
Right, it's just directly out of the Fed.
Bankrolled directly from the Fed that has their own printing presses. How convenient. And then you've got them also going to end up, according to Mr. Fisher at the Dallas Fed, with 24 to 25% of all Treasury debt by the end of this QE project.
Okay, and see, you keep saying the end of this QE project, and Fisher's talking about the end of this QE project, and Yellen and Bernanke were talking about the end of this QE project, but who's going to buy this stuff at zero rates or low rates if the Federal Reserve is not buying all this, Dave? Who's going to be the buyer?
Right. Well, if you don't have the buyer, this is the problem. If it's not the Fed, then it's our foreigners. If it's not the foreigners, then it's us here in the U.S. I mean, keep in mind, the one way you can convince Americans to buy treasuries, what would in past eras have been called certificates of confiscation, is under the auspices of war and your support of a nationalist effort. You know, there's no doubt you can roll that drumbeat and basically say you have to do your patriotic duty. Help us fight the bad guys. Help us fight the evil. Help us win the victory. It's now or never. That kind of language and ethos and pathos gets tied up into the selling of government paper when worse comes to worse. And so, you know, one of the things that you can ask is, when we get to the end of it and no one is willing to buy our treasuries, is this not a point in time where in times past, history would say, yeah, it's about time to start a war. It's about time to start throwing mud. We're looking for more heat than light in conversations, diplomatically speaking. Why? Well, because it serves some domestic problems for us. It solves those domestic problems.
Well, the way the market would work, if it was normal and quantitative easing had ended and you wanted to inspire the buyer, if it's not sex appeal in Japan, like you said, you know, it's actually going to be higher interest rates. Higher interest rates usually, I mean, that's what that market is. You pay a certain amount of interest rates.
And so it becomes more appealing.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what? There's nothing wrong with higher rates. We would end up probably with a higher dollar as well in terms of values. But that's if it's only healthy, and you can only move rates higher if you don't have a huge stock of debt already. and a fairly short maturity structure for that debt. In other words, we have a lot of implicit rollover risk in our treasuries, and that's a tough thing to do because, you know, yes, interest rates moving up might be fine for the dollar, but it's not fine for our fiscal picture because, again, what we saw last year, we mentioned this before, is the line item, interest line item on the national debt went from $250 billion to over $400 billion, 9% of total tax revenues to close to 15% of tax revenues. And that was just the minor hiccup in interest rates May and June of 2013. Mm-hmm. If you go back to more normalized rates and we're 200-300 basis points higher than we currently are,
it'll take our revenues.
Well, it'll take our revenues. And then when we have to refinance that debt, it's going to be at considerably higher numbers.
Right.
At considerably higher numbers. And then the question is this really the event that S&P, Moody's, and Fitch have been looking for? Downgrade potential, which, you know, then you've got a non-virtuous cycle reinforcing kind of a negative feedback loop, if you will. I want to go back to the junk bonds and the high yield paper because this is a critical thing, and I think it relates to where we were last year with the gold market. Better than 10% of the junk bond market today, what they call high yield, trades in exchange-traded funds.
ETFs.
That's right. Okay. So you've got J&K, HYG, a couple of ticker symbols. There's a number of other bundled consumer products that you can buy and sell, and you basically are buying a basket of junk or high-yield bonds. As we witnessed in the gold rout last year, April to June of 2013, the ETF liquidations extended a trend and exaggerated price volatility by concentrating volumes in a very short period of time. Now, the key distinction with the coming rout in high-yield bonds with that of gold last year is that China and India stood ready to purchase any quantity of tons at lower prices in the gold market.
Yeah, 700 or 800 tons came out of the ETFs, and 700 or 800 tons went straight to China and India. Now, okay, but a junk bond fund. Who buys junk bonds when they come out at in that kind of level?
It's unclear who is the buyer of last resort in not only the bond market, but specifically the high yield or junk market. In that space, you're dealing with credit ratings that are as low as they go, right, and you're dealing with enterprises who have raised the capital. They're already paying premiums in those high-yield offerings, and frankly, they're not likely to be going concerns in a period of high stress. So who dreams of junk? I don't know. I don't know who dreams of junk, but I know a lot of cultures that prize gold, that dream of gold, and don't treat it like junk. When it's on sale, they buy it hand over fist. When junk goes on sale, it basically is circling the drain.
Sure. And it can go to zero. You know, gold's never gone to zero. This is why the Chinese were buying it. But a junk bond purchase from China, I seriously doubt it when everybody's flowing out.
So I'm not quite sure how we do this, but yields are today almost exactly where they were last April. Near record lows and interest rate volatility, the stuff that we saw last year, it was due to the announcement of a reduction in Fed quantitative easing measures, the famous taper. Markets, I just have to ask the question, are they ignoring the risks? Do markets believe that the Fed is here to stay, that they're actually not going to ease off? Well, they already have. They were promising $85 billion to the market, and now they're promising $55 billion, and that may wind down to nothing by October. Well, so again, do markets believe that the Fed's here to stay? Do they believe that some other central bank is going to continue an extraordinary asset purchase? Or, and this I think is where the answer is, or are investors doubly blinded by the belief that when central bankers have all the power in the universe and are exercising it for the quote-unquote good of the people? And two, are they being equally blinded by their need for income? I see this happen so many times where someone prioritizes their financial need and ignores fundamental variables in the market in order to get what they want. And they're not respecters of the marketplace. Because I can tell you this, the marketplace is no respecter of you as an investor.
Well, and the Federal Reserve has really retrained people. You know, I had a client send me an article from a broker that writes a newsletter that said, you know, we really are not giving the Fed enough credit. We really need to pat them on the back. Not only do they save us from a financial catastrophe, but they're really managing things quite well, and inflation's really not an issue. So it seems that even the pros at this point have been retrained to just eliminate risk. There's just no reason to pay for it.
Kevin, I think it's utterly delusional. Where we started this conversation, we're assuming that there won't be a hitch with the current policies, we're assuming there won't be any intended consequences, and we're looking in the rearview mirror, a very short gap in time from when these policies were implemented till now, and we're assuming that we have an insight into the future based on what has happened just immediately in the past. I think you have more activity coming from the central banks in Europe. You've got Draghi, who is, again, as I suggested earlier, buying down rates or suggesting buying down rates in the corporate space. And it's periods of time like this, Kevin, where you have so much distortion in terms of price that it seems the better time to be moving to cash. It seems the better time to be denominating that in a currency that has stood the test of time. I'm regularly asking myself the question these days, do I own enough ounces?
Right, because you say cash is ounces.
And
at this point,
that's the way I treat those ounces. I don't treat them as a potential growth asset. I'm looking at the rest of the world as incredibly overpriced, and I want out.
Yeah.
But I look at the dollar and I look at how it's managed or mismanaged by the central bank, not only in a long period of time, losing 97% of the value of its purchasing power, but even in a short period of time, the last 10 years. On a Greenspan, Bernanke, Yellen watch, we've lost 33% of the value. And that's just in a 14-year stretch. Kevin, I don't want my savings managed by PhDs. I want something that has stood the test of time. And so, do I own enough ounces? And I personally continue to add both to gold and silver. And I just feel that in a world of inflated values and contrived prices, compliments of the Fed, you really should go back to the basics.
Well, and one of the things you've talked to all of us about is set your goal. You say, guys, set your goal on how many ounces of gold you want to have and how many ounces of silver. It's a different way of thinking for me because I've always drawn the triangle for clients. And I've said, okay, one-third of the portfolio definitely goes into precious metals. The other two-thirds are in, you know, the other things. But
stocks, bonds, cash, what have you.
Exactly. But you've sort of changed our mindset around here. Not just we still go for the third, but you've also said for a metals position, how many ounces of gold is the right amount of ounces? It's good to set a goal.
Yeah, think about it. I mean, an owner of 30 ounces of gold is in the top 1% of all gold owners in the world.
So a lot of people listening already know that they're in the top 1%.
I mean, on a per capita basis, given the number of ounces in the world, 174,000 tons, you could only own, I mean, if it was proportioned equally, you could only own about 0.69 of an ounce, less than 1 ounce of gold. So to own 30 ounces, you are a big owner of gold in the world. This is how scarce it actually is. What is your goal? Is it 30 ounces? Is it 300 ounces? Is it 3,000 ounces? What about in the silver category? Do you want to set a long-term goal? Maybe this is a high bar for you to get to. 100 ounces of silver? 1,000 ounces of silver? 100,000 ounces of silver? Stop thinking in dollar terms and try to make progress towards that goal. That, by the way, when the price gets cheaper, do you know how much easier it is to attain your goal? You can buy a few more ounces at $20 silver than you can at $40 silver.
Sure, you've changed your thinking. When the market goes down, I've noticed you've changed your thinking.
I do like to get closer and closer to those goals. But, you know, 2 years ago, I knew what my goals were. I had them on paper at that point, right. And I was trying to figure out what would that look like at $36 silver. I feel like a pig in slop being able to buy at 20 bucks.
So thank you, Goldman Sachs. Thank you, Merrill Lynch. It really was not that bad.
Well, at least on the gold side.
Break in the price side.
Yeah, at least on the gold side. Thank you, the CME Group, and thank you, those very connected into the inner workings of the silver market for, precipitating. I don't think that the market is entirely manipulated, but I do think there are reasons to look at strange behavior and policies that are done, whether it's margin requirements that increase when they should decrease when they should increase. These things do represent a plot that is, in my mind, thickening. The bigger plot is how do we survive the final throes of a socialist experiment? And that's where we're at today. We have a central bank serving a central government that assumes that they know best. They always know best, and that we should just play along. It brings me back to that whole issue of do I own enough ounces? Because this is all a grand experiment. We haven't been here before in exactly this way, but I'm not convinced it's going to end well. And I continue to ask that same question. Do I own enough ounces?
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or just give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.